طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning, our Palestinian voice is that of Kitam Edelby, who has been a frequent guest on This Week in Palestine as she returns from her home in East Jerusalem to Cambridge each summer to work on her PhD in expressive therapies at Lesley University. Good morning, Kitam.
Good morning.
Let's begin at the beginning. What is expressive therapies, and what role can it play in promoting healing to the Palestinian people living under Israeli military occupation?
It's actually expressive art therapy. It's okay. Using different kind of art modalities, such as drama, theater, music, movement, writing, and these modalities are this what I studied at Lesley's, and this what I did my master's, and went back to Palestine trying to use these modalities. And the reason I'm using different kind of modalities is because not every kid, not every mother, not every teenager likes the same thing. Like some people like more to paint more than doing a drama. Some people like to move more than singing. Some prefer to play music instead of doing drama. So I try to offer different kind of modalities in order to provide them with variety of art. It's for the sake of expressing ourselves, not for the sake of the art product. So we do art to express ourselves, and we do art to find how creative we are, and we do art to find how we can use art to tell our story or to tell our thoughts or to share our thoughts. So basically the main purpose of the expressive art is to use it to express ourselves and find our creativity and find that path that shows how creative we can be, even if we don't exhibit our art or if we don't do performance in the end of our art.
But there's therapeutic value.
There is. Yes. Basically, to express ourselves, and this is the first step in the therapeutic path. And then on that we can build. So when we work with kids and they like to paint, we can see what is it they like to paint about, and we give them the opportunity to tell the story about their painting, and from there we learn where we can go and or how we can help them. So it is, of course, it's also for the sake of therapeutic path more than for the sake of artistic path.
Right. And specifically, how are you using it in your projects in Palestine? You go back from here each summer, and you work most of the year doing expressive art therapy.
Part of the work I do with teachers, I train teachers about how to use different kind of art modalities with their students. Basically, with the students who have learning issues or learning difficulties, sometimes it's easier for them to learn through art, and sometimes it's easier for them to express themselves through art. So with the students who have learning issues, we found out that when we use different kind of art, it motivates them to participate more and to express themselves more. And in many cases, they learn through that what they are doing and what they are creating. So the teachers who take the training, they take it in a way that they can facilitate it, they can conduct it with their students within the class. With women, I use expressive art sessions where I give them the opportunity to share stories, to tell about their stories, sometimes also to do art if they want to do art, to sing if they like to sing, and sometimes they, you know, also we discuss stuff that is important to them and discuss stuff that interests them, and sometimes we paint about that stuff, or we make songs about that stuff, or sometimes even we make sculptures. So we, you know, we use also recycled materials, and mothers like it because it gives them the opportunity to tell about themselves and to share their stuff, but also it provides them with some tools that they can use with their kids at home. So what they take with me, sometimes they can use with their kids. With teenagers, I use different kind of art modalities, but they do also, I find it that the most they like is to do acting and drama, so I do that with them. With adults, you can do expressive art with all population, with young kids, teenagers, adults, as long as you are not judging them, you don't give points to their work, you just say that you support the work and you give good feedback, positive feedback. Yes, you can do it. Yes, you can make it. If you judge and if you give negative feedback, this definitely stops them from creating more and more.
Specifically, what populations are you working with? You're talking about working with women, talking about working with young people. What? Tell us something about the actual groups you're working with.
Right now, for the last 2 years, and hopefully for this coming year, I'm working on three different projects. One project takes place in Qalandia refugee camp, where I work with a group of adolescents, teenagers, from the camp. And last couple of months, I did my research with one group, contained 12 teenagers who came to participate in the research, and the research was about using playback theater with teenagers. I had a specialist with me in playback theater, so she was conducting the work and I was observing and taking notes and videos and pictures. And playback theater is a new method, and it's a new theater tool that is based on stories that come from audience. One of the audience tells the story, and the actors are trained to improvise and act out the story that comes from the audience. So I'm planning to go back to work with this specific group, because when we evaluated the program, they said, yes, we do need more sessions, and yes, we would love to do more drama and the playback theater. So the teenagers will be a project for them in Qalandia. I lead a project in Arab al-Jahalin village. The project was initiated by a beautiful young lady, social worker from the village, from Arab al-Jahalin. So we both lead the group, and we work with women, but also some young ladies work with teenagers and children. So the project locates in a van, stable van, not moving van.
Right, yeah.
And it's like it became like a center that opens its doors 5 days a week for children, teenagers, and women. The other project that I started last year, last summer, was in Khan al-Ahmar village, the village that is under the threat of demolition.
Is this a Bedouin village?
It is.
Yeah.
Arab al-Jahalin and Khan al-Ahmar both are Bedouin villages. Khan al-Ahmar locates on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. And in Khan al-Ahmar, there is also school that we work also in it with the students there. So the project in Khan al-Ahmar actually takes two lanes, one lane with the mothers and one lane with the students. So we work a couple of hours with the mothers and a couple of hours with the student. And the whole idea is to give them the opportunity to practice art and to do art and to express themselves through art, but also in Khan al-Ahmar, basically to tell them that we are here for you. And even if they demolish the village, we're going to continue the project no matter whether they demolish.
We'll follow them.
We're going to follow them. We're going to go with them no matter where they take them to. Hopefully the village will not be demolished, but we do know that if the Israeli Supreme Court took the decision, this is going to be sooner or later.
And why is Israel demolishing this village? What
we know that they want to bridge between two big settlements, Ma'ali Adumim settlement and Mishor Adumim. They locate a little bit far from each other. And this village that locates there for more than 60 years now became like an obstacle to build this road that will connect between the two settlements. So we assume that bridge, that road that they're going to build between the two settlements will be on that land, the village
land. This land is in the West Bank.
Yes.
This is land which part of the 22% of the land which is designated for Palestine, but which Israel is eroding, is taking. And this is part of the taking of this land. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the people are fighting against the decision, and people say, not on our dead body. What happened in 1948 will never ever happen again.
Yeah.
Because they were relocated from the Negev, from Naqab, 60 years ago. So it's like if they are transferred this time, this is going to be the second time where they are relocated and taken out from their land. So people have a huge amount of resilience right now, and they are very aware of not accepting that and fighting against that. And they do get good supporters, good volunteers, and press all over the place most of the time. And they do have what they call Khemet al-I'tisam. It's a big tent that was built to welcome guests and supporters and volunteers who come daily there and to give support and push and tell them that we are here for you. So this helps so far, but we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But no matter what happens, we're going to follow the village and we're going to continue the work, because right now we have 15 women who come weekly to the session, and they are very committed. And the school opened its door for us, so we do also activities with the students in the school. And this is the only school in that service the Bedouin committees in that area. There is no other school where the kids could go if this school is demolished. So if they If they demolish this school, the other four villages around Al-Khan al-Ahmar will never ever benefit from this school. Then their kids have to go either to Jericho or to Al-Izariya up. So hopefully this village...
And it's a problem, particularly for girls, to be traveling.
It's not that easy. And Bedouin Committee, it's a conservative, and it's not that easy to leave the village and take that public transportations, and they do it if they have to do it. But as long as they have a school within the village, they rather have that. But if they demolish the school, yes, they will send their kids to other schools because they want their kids.
They will.
Yeah, they will. They will. Yeah, because they want their kids to gain knowledge and to gain learning and to gain, you know, they will send them, of course.
And if I hear you right, the role that expressive art therapy plays is also part of the resistance movement.
Part of it, it's like hidden agenda.
Yeah, I mean, it really
we don't
is.
Talk much politics, but every time we arrive there, they talk about the situation. And you can't divide the life from the political situation because it's all blended together. So it's not that I avoid talking politics, I just leave it to them. If they want to talk about the situation, it's up to them. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to, it's up to them as well. It's not that they live in it.
Right.
They have it day and night. It's not our, I don't feel that I have a mission to talk with them about their problems.
Yeah.
I am there to listen to their problems if they want to talk about their problems.
Yeah.
And if the problems about political situation, it's okay, we talk about political situation. But we do deal with other stuff. We talk about other stuff. We make food sometimes, we make a breakfast together, we do art, sometimes we bring subjects that matter to them, like how to deal with adolescents' age, how to deal with the children, with sort of symptoms. So it's not mainly about politics, about everything.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So how are you going to sustain this? How are you going to replicate yourself? How do you build this expressive therapies movement? My understanding is that before you, there was no one really doing expressive therapies.
Actually, we had some, but basically in Jerusalem, not in West Bank. The whole idea of expressive art therapy is not a huge thing. It's not a huge thing in Palestine. Now it's getting better. More and more people are asking for it and seeking it and are more aware of it. And we are... the very little amount of expressive art therapists are working so hard to expand their work and to reach as much as they can. Indeed, we need more art therapists in Palestine because of the big need. And indeed, we need to reach out more and more people because of the checkpoints. Sometimes people can't reach us. That's why in my experience, the more I go out, the more I reach people. I can't sit in an office or a clinic and wait for the people to come to me.
No.
That's why I have my mobile art car where I have all my stuff in it, and I go out to reach people.
And you're training teachers.
I train teachers.
And
I work.
Mothers. And,
and
adults.
Yeah.
And they use this.
Part of the work is to train teachers in order to expand the experience. Yeah. And working with mothers for their benefits and for their kids' benefits. Sometimes also I work with counselors. I train counselors who could use the expressive art with their patients.
And it is popular. In other words, kids are coming back, mothers are coming back, people are seeking it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it's really serving.
Yeah. Because they do get fun.
Yeah.
No judgmental attitude. We respect all their products. We respect the work they do. And they feel safe that they can tell and share and participate. So yeah, in general, they come back. Yeah.
Now, you're finishing up your PhD.
Hopefully.
You finished your coursework. You're working on your thesis. You plan to graduate in 2020.
Yep, this is the plan.
And you will have your PhD and you will go back. And what difference does the PhD make? What do you want to do with the PhD? How do you want... You've worked incredibly hard to get this degree. And now you've got it. You've almost got it.
You know
you're going to get it. What difference will that make in terms of the development of expressive art therapy in Palestine to have...
It's teaching, it's about, basically it's about learning and learning and learning. Mm. The more we gain learning, the more we gain knowledge. So I feel that, I'm more wise now, I am more mature now, I have more knowledge now. Indeed, I still have long way to go, you know. But after I finish the program, the next goal is to teach at universities in Palestine. Hopefully I will manage to do that. And I want to do that not only for the sake of teaching, but for the sake of integrating these methods, this program in our schools, in our universities. They teach them all over the world, except the Palestinian universities. None of our universities. And we do have good amount of universities, 7 or 8 universities in Palestine, which is not bad. And they do teach art. They do have art departments, but no. And they do have therapy departments or psychology, but they don't have that one that integrates both art and therapy.
Yeah.
And hopefully I will manage to do that.
And so at the moment there's no one teaching at that level.
No.
So you'd be the first.
If they accept me, if they welcome me, I will try to knock the doors.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Well, has it become more difficult for you to move? You say you drive your car, you move around, you go to the villages, you go to the camps. To move around, what's happening with the occupation in terms of your ability to move around to the camps?
Yeah. So far, because I have yellow plate, the Israeli plate, for the last couple of years, I'm not facing big obstacles to get into places, unless sometimes when they put closure on certain areas, I can't get in. Like if they close the main entrance of Khan al-Ahmar, of course, I will not be able to go. So far, I was able to do that for the last year. To get to Qalandia, it's open to go there, unless sometimes it's a huge, ugly traffic because of the checkpoint. And if something happens around the checkpoint, everything gets closed.
Everything stops.
Then we can't, like in April, clashes occurred and resulting one martyr and some were arrested, some got injured. So the whole camp was upside down for a couple of days, mourning, a general strike. So we couldn't do the sessions. We canceled one session. For some sessions, just a few boys came because people were a little bit scared to come or to go out or to just to feel free outside. You know, the situation were really awful. So sometimes It's hard because of the general situation to get in.
Yeah.
But in general, so far, as we say, so far, so good. So,
You grew up in Israel.
In Palestine 48.
Yeah, Palestine 48. And you now live in East Jerusalem.
Between both, yeah, actually. Between the north and Jerusalem.
But you travel, and your husband lives in Acre, which is...
2.5 hours drive from Jerusalem.
Yeah. now... Do you have any trouble traveling?
Maybe? No. To go into the north from Jerusalem. If you locate in Jerusalem and you go to the north, it's very easy. You just need to drive, because the north and Jerusalem is considered Israel, as if you are driving within Israel. Mm. So there is no checkpoints, no obstacles, roads, nothing. The problem is when you go from Jerusalem to West Bank. Then you have to go via checkpoints. Or you come from West Bank to Jerusalem, no way without passing through checkpoints. So if I go to West Bank and get back to Jerusalem, yes, I have to go back through checkpoints. And they check the cars, they check the ID. But from Jerusalem to the north, to Acre, to Haifa, no, you have no checkpoints. It's easy going, easy driving. No problem.
Well, but your husband cannot live in the West Bank. Is that right?
No, he can't. I can't. We live in the West Bank as well. We are not allowed with the Israeli passport. You are not allowed to live in the West Bank. Anyways, you can live in Jerusalem. You can't.
But you need. Not everyone can live in Jerusalem. It's you have to have a Jerusalem ID in order to live in Jerusalem.
Yeah. Now, I mean, people from West Bank, of course, they can't live in Jerusalem because they have the Palestinian ID, the West Bank ID. Of course, they can't live in Jerusalem. But only Jerusalem who were born, Palestinians from Jerusalem who were born in Jerusalem, can live in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
We from the north... Yes, we can, if we want to live in Jerusalem. But people from West Bank, they can't.
So, does that include your husband?
My husband is a little bit different because he has French passport and Jordanian passport. And the reason he couldn't live in Jerusalem, because he had to get because we got married and he had to get to the Israeli ID. And in order to get the Israeli ID, he had to be in the north. Not because he had a West Bank ID, no. Not because of that. But because he had a different ID, like the French one and the Jordanian one. And in order to get the Israeli ID, he had to be in the north. Yeah.
Oh, there's so many difficulties like this.
I mean, it's really hard even to understand. I'm sure that even if some people listen to what I'm saying now, it seems very complicated.
It is
hard to understand. It's complicated unless you go there and you, from close, you see how it is while you are there.
Yeah.
It's really hard to understand it from far. Like I always say, it's really hard for people to understand how we live between these or among these checkpoints. Unless you go there and you see how we live among these checkpoints. Because it's not easy to understand. It's not easy to have the picture if you are far.
Yeah.
How you go from here, if you go from there, no, you take this road. So it is complicated. It is.
Yeah. Yeah, and what eases it a bit for you is your ability to get the yellow plates, to get the...
I have it. I mean, I have it because I have the Israeli ID. I have it. It's not that something that I asked for. It comes together. In general, it's fine unless they close West Bank and they don't allow people who have Israeli ID to get in. And it happened more than once that they say you are not allowed to get in because we want to protect you, or we are afraid that something going to happen to you. So it happened more than once. Not recently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you ever have trouble entering or leaving the country? Do you ever have trouble getting visas?
No. In general, I mean, yeah. When I apply for, you mean for the states?
Yeah. To
Europe, we don't need visa. With the Israeli passport, you can easily go to Europe. But you do have to have visa to come to the states, and we apply a couple of weeks in advance. And usually I had student visa for many years, and I had a traveling visa for many years. I never got a problem in that, no.
And that's eased by the fact that you have an Israeli passport.
I assume so, and my record is clean.
Yeah, but if you didn't have that, if you just had the Palestinian
passport, it's different.
Yeah.
It's different. I don't know how much complicated is that, how much hard, but I do know that the process is way harder than my process.
So, and don't you have to go through Jordan? You
in order to come here?
Yeah.
No, I don't have to.
No, you don't have to, but if that only have Palestinian.
Yes, I assume so.
They have to go through Jordan.
I assume so.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
That's much more difficult. Okay, well, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to...
No, thank you.
This is wonderful. You've been coming each year, and the end is in sight, and we're very excited, and I know you're very excited.
Thank you.
And so when you come back to graduate, we're going to have you back on This Week
thank
in Palestine.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Katan.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Palestinian expressive art therapist Kitam Edelby, who was spent the summer in Cambridge doing research on her PhD thesis at Lesley University. Kitam is on track to graduate in May of 2020. We want to spend the remaining portion of our program this morning discussing the infamous Israeli lobby, which has many tentacles reaching into the heart of American society, from infiltration into our colleges and universities to many structures within our federal, state, and local governments. The chief focus is to eliminate the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, created by a Palestinian civil society as a nonviolent resistance movement to the Israeli military occupation of the Palestinian homeland. The BDS movement has become such a threat to Israel that it is trying to make the BDS movement illegal or punishable at the international and local levels of government. Under international law, an occupied people have the right to resist. Palestinians have chosen a nonviolent means of resistance through the BDS movement, and Israel's response is to make support of the nonviolent movement punishable and illegal. In the United States, the right to boycott is constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. Yet the Israeli lobby is pushing to take that right away at both the state and federal level. How does the lobby work? We want you to hear an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal, which took place in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and exposes how the lobby works to oppose BDS. Here is Max Blumenthal running it all down.
Your talk here is titled Occupied Politics, Israel's War Against Palestine and Its Supporters. I want you to say a word about the Israel lobby. I mean, who it is, what it is, how it operates, who funds it, specifically its influence on politicians, on Congress, on the executive branch, et cetera. And as part of that, maybe say a word about how it makes its way down, not only on the national level, but on college campuses, for example, with Canary Mission, and then the other groups that you see its impact on.
Yeah, I mean, what is the Israel lobby? The Israel lobby is a very atomized structure of organizations that all act for a single goal, which is to protect America's special relationship with Israel, no matter what Israel does, and to ensure permanent American support for the state of Israel in the form of billions of dollars of loans, but also cultural support for Israel. And that means that the Israel lobby not only functions within Washington as this juggernaut, which, as Ilhan Omar correctly said, essentially pays politicians to support Israel and punishes politicians who don't sufficiently support Israel by running challenge candidates against them, but it also functions in Fort Wayne, in any community in the U.S., through organizations like the Jewish Federations to try to shut down talks at churches where a speaker will come to present another view of Palestine. They will try to prevent books from appearing, like my book Goliath, that were harshly critical of Israel. And they will even attack art exhibitions. For example, an exhibition of children's art from the Gaza Strip was canceled under pressure from the San Francisco Jewish Federations from showing. So they aim to impose total full-spectrum dominance on every sphere of life in the country to prevent anything from slipping through the cracks that could show Americans another perspective on Israel-Palestine. And that's very dangerous because it's anti-democratic, and it's resulted in them, as they lose control over the debate, turning to state power in the form of anti-BDS bills that punish Americans or American companies that refuse to do business with Israel with fines and even threats of, I don't think they're going to jail terms yet, but fines and lawsuits are definitely in the offing. And then you have Canary Mission, as you mentioned, which is a website designed explicitly by the people behind it who have concealed their identities to deny employment to college students because they are active in Palestine solidarity on campus. And so it consists of dossiers of students who are said to be terrorists or anti-Semites or extremists because of what they did on campus in support of Palestinian equality. It's essentially a McCarthyite blacklisting site. And the point is anonymity. No one knows who's behind it, except we do know who's behind it. We know what operation is behind it. It's part of the Israel lobby, and it is working hand in glove with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, which is a special ministry created to combat the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and is run by Gilad Erdan, who is a pretty unspectacular Israeli minister, not exactly, you know, the sharpest guy. But behind him is a former Israeli Shin Bet agent named Simon Vaknin Gil, who is really the brains behind the operation. And she coordinates between these Israel lobby groups and the Israeli intelligence services. So when you look at the Israel lobby, you know, your neighbors who work with the Jewish Federation, who, you know, you might be friendly with, they don't maybe coordinate with the Israeli government. But some of their research and what they're doing, you know, when they do research on various figures in Fort Wayne, who's coming to speak here, who's doing the activism, could still make its way into Israel's database. Same with Canary Mission. You know, they're relying on pro-Israel student groups on campus, which often are Jewish groups, which is really unfortunate because a lot of these students don't realize that, don't think of themselves as working on behalf of Israel. But their research on students goes into Israel's intelligence database, and many people who wound up on Canary Mission's blacklist have been denied entry by Israel on the basis of the fact that they were on Canary Mission's blacklist. So the Israel lobby is essentially acting on behalf of a foreign apartheid state, and yet none of these organizations, including AIPAC, the big juggernaut, are registered as foreign agents.
And this is bipartisan. I mean, Republican, Democrat, Independent, right? I mean, this is the Israel lobby has its tentacles into both parties at its very root.
Absolutely. I think there is a clash coming in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But the Israel lobby was central in the career of Cory Booker, in creating Cory Booker as a national politician. His biggest donor was NORPAC, which is actually more extreme than AIPAC, openly Islamophobic, and had taken positions that AIPAC hadn't taken, because AIPAC's duty in its oath is to abide by the policy of whoever Israelis elect as prime minister. So NORPAC took its own position, which was to the right of AIPAC, and that's who supported Cory Booker for much of his career. Until recently, he's now saying, I'm not taking PAC money, because he doesn't need it anymore. But yeah, so the Democratic Party has the toxins of the Israel lobby in its veins as well.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal exposing the workings of the Israeli lobby. Before we go this morning, we want to call your attention to an expose documentary of the Israeli lobby filmed by Al Jazeera reporters who infiltrated the lobby to document their modus operandi in the United States. However, the documentary has never been officially released. Why? No one seems to know. Previously, Al Jazeera did a similar documentary on the Israeli lobby in the United Kingdom, and that is readily available in four parts on YouTube. However, the documentary, The Israeli Lobby USA, was completed but never released. The good news is that it was leaked to the Electronic Intifada and is available in parts on the Electronic Intifada website. If one persists, it can also be found on YouTube, but it is not as accessible as the United Kingdom version. Everyone should see this documentary, The Israeli Lobby USA, to understand what the Israeli lobby is really all about. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbz.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time. We hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.